Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 13, Side 1. When Johnny gave them the shock that was planned, they might react in violence. It would be like swimming in a river full of crocodiles. Colonel Ivan made up his mind. If they hurt Johnny, not one of these fine lords or these bank people would leave Earth alive. But that was no immediate help for Johnny if they turned on him, and that they well might do. Angus was kneeling by the atmosphere projector, putting some final touches to the adjustments. He glanced across the bowl, saw what was happening, and speeded his work up. They would need it in a moment. Stormalong, frustrated, fluttered the dispatch in his hand and, still restrained by Ivan, watched the last of the lords file in. Then there went Sir Robert and Johnny following them. Inside the conference room, the host was adjusting chairs and helping the lords get settled. The small gray men and McAdam and Baron von Roth entered and took seats along the wall. Sir Robert stood with Johnny alongside the raised platform. Sir Robert was shooting glances at the lords from under bushy gray eyebrows. Somehow these mighty powers had to be brought to heel. He did not much mind tearing into them. He just hoped the final outcome would not be disaster. Martial music came on. The host stood up.
My lords, this final stage of the conference has been called by the emissary of Earth. I present Sir Robert.
It did not start well. There was a buzz among the lords. They looked askance toward Voraz. Wasn't this supposed to be an auction? What was the Earth emissary doing talking to them? Sir Robert, in his regimentals, took the center of the platform. The mine spotlight came on. My lords, he said in a heavy, sonorous voice, we have something else to discuss besides auctions.
You mean, called Faljapan, that we have been delayed here for days for nothing?
Our food and atmosphere supply is running out, shouted Lord Dom, and we are long overdue. Is all this just a waste of time?
They were turning ugly. Voraz was signifying nothing, just sitting there, expressionless. He had a very poor opinion of this whole action.
My lords, said Sir Robert, loud enough to be heard across a battlefield. Of recent times, there has been talk among you about a reward.
They quieted instantly. A reward was something to engage one's attention.
Two sums of money, said Sir Robert, each amounting to 100 million credits, have been put out to encourage a certain search. It was, he shouted, to find the one.
The lords went very alert.
There is the one.
And his hand shot out, pointing at Johnny. The mine spotlight shifted to Johnny, and his buttons and helmet flashed fire. It was dramatic, a sudden intake of breath from the lords. It was not exactly as Johnny had planned it. Sir Robert had let his own feelings change it. Still, it was very effective. Sir Robert resumed in a strong, triumphant voice.
With the help of a few Scots, he put a total end to the most powerful empire in 16 universes. That man, cried Sir Robert, put a finish on an empire that had crushed and awed you all. Among you, you have 5,000 planets. He put an end to an empire of over 1 million planets.
The delegates sat very still. They were afraid of what might be coming, but they were impressed.
Now, do you want to see what he did that ended Cyclo forever?
There was no wait for an answer. Four Russians and Colonel Ivan raced into the room with the mine cart that carried the atmosphere projector. They put it smartly in place, and then drew back to the wall and stood there at attention. Sir Robert touched a remote relay. The mine spotlight went off, the projector went on. The view of the Imperial City just before the cataclysm leaped up over the platform. There, as though in visual sight, lay the moving, brilliantly etched ramparts of mighty Cyclo. Few of the emissaries had ever seen full pictures of it. It would have been worth their lives ever to have set foot in the place. But they recognized the domes of the palace from Cyclo seals. Just seeing Cyclo was an experience. And then the catastrophe rolled on. They held their breaths. Never had such widespread, violent disaster met their gaze. Cyclo, engulfed in a hellish, molten death before their staring eyes, turned into a scorching, blazing sun. The picture went off. The mine spotlight did not come on. Sir Robert's voice battered them from the dark.
Think of the oppression of Cyclo. Think of how it altered every part of the lives of nations. Think of what its tyranny has done. And realize now, it is over and ended, finished forever. You owe this man,
the mine spotlight hit Johnny,
a huge debt for freeing you from a monster.
The emissaries were not accustomed to fear. They felt afraid. Sir Robert bored on. He had discarded Johnny's orders. He felt too strongly himself. And he hated these pitiless lords who had possibly ended Scotland.
You have seen what he can do to such a planet as Cyclo. Now, I am going to show you what else he can do.
Sir Robert killed the mine spotlight. He hit the projector remote. The complete sequence of the Talnep moon came on. They had viewed bits of this before, but they had not seen the whole finish of that moon, for it had been taken after the fight with Slime. Before them, the moon began to crumble and pucker in. The great ship that had tried to escape was eaten up before their eyes once more. And then the views from the Talnep mountaintop came on. Johnny, too, had not seen these. Unless one looked hard, the moon seemed to be turning into gas. And then the gas began to liquefy in the intense cold of space. The scenes of the piece of scrap iron falling in had a part in it Johnny had not seen. Just before it entered the surface of the moon, a tongue of lightning roared at it. For an instant, it went red hot, and then, striking the liquefying gas, crumbled as it visibly drifted down to the still fluid core. That moon was now a ball, not just of gas, but of uncountable quintillions of megavolts of electricity. The separation of atoms had generated enormous charge, but there being no oxygen and no second pole to cause flow, the intense cold of space had frozen the resulting electricity. Johnny realized this was how cyclofuel worked, but it had no heavy metal in it, only the more base metals. And that moon would kill any ship that came near it, not by disintegration, but by huge, powerful charges of electricity. Ah, there came a meteor. Lightning flashed out and melted it. The emissaries had seen a planet roar into the heat of a sun. Now, they were seeing a moon vanish and then congeal into a cold, deadly, frigid mass of destruction. Sir Robert's voice went into them like shockwaves.
He can do that to your home planet, at will.
Had he hit them with a stun gun, he could not have produced a more frozen effect.
And, cried Sir Robert, that is nothing you can do to stop it.
Johnny had not planned it this strong, but Sir Robert was getting his revenge. The mine spotlight hit Johnny. Sir Robert shouted at them,
He is going to put 28 fighting platforms in 28 separate places, none of them on this planet. Your home planet coordinates are going to be set. Those 28 platforms are going to fire, all 28 of them, if any one of you turns hostile.
This was not what Johnny had told him to say. The 28 platforms, yes, but not...
All you have to do, Sir Robert bellowed at them, is get one small inch out of line, and all your home planets will become exactly like that moon.
They were in paralyzed shock.
You, cried Sir Robert, all of you are going to sign a treaty that forbids war with us and war between yourselves. If you don't... Your home planets, all of them, will disintegrate just like that moon, and you and all your people will go with them?
He pointed again at Johnny.
He can do it and will do it. So get right to work and sign the treaty now.
Bedlam. Every emissary came out of his seat screaming with rage. Colonel Ivan and the troopers tensed. The din almost caved in one's ears. Sir Robert glared at them, feeling triumphant. Johnny walked to the center of the platform. The spotlight followed him. He raised his hands to quiet them. The tumult eased off a bit. A final cry from Browl expressed the sentiments of them all.
This is a declaration of war.
Johnny stood there. Gradually his presence brought silence. It is not a declaration of war, he said. It is a declaration of peace. I know that your economics are geared to war. I know that you consider the best way to get rid of excess population, which you feel you all have, is to engage in war. But in wars, one or another of the combatants is going to lose. Each one feels that it could not be he. But there is an even chance it will be. So, in declaring peace, we are only protecting you from each other. Valjapan suddenly shouted,
When we get home, we can send vast armadas against you. Even if you slay all of us, those fleets will still come and destroy you. And as for you, you have laid yourself open to assassination.
Sir Robert was suddenly in front of Johnny.
Your fleets will not save your own planets. There is no defense you have against these platforms. Only this one man would know where they are. And if 30 days passed without his resetting them, if anything happened to him and he was not there, those platforms would fire automatically. If something happened to him or to Earth, the home planets of every one of you would be destroyed. Also, he has doubles. They look exactly like him. You cannot tell the difference. If you thought you were assassinating him, you would probably only be assassinating a double. And if any double is harmed or touched, those firing platforms fire, all of them. It is up to you to protect Earth and to protect him. The lives of you, your rulers, and your people depend upon it. And as to your fleets coming and destroying us, they might well do so. But if you don't get home, they won't know. They would attack here and have no base or people or rulers to return to. Think about that.
You are threatening emissaries, shouted Browl.
He is protecting emissaries, snapped Sir Robert. With your war industries tooling up to go full blast, there is more than one in this room who will be representing a government conquered by another.
You should look at a principle known as force majeure. It means that an unexpected and uncontrollable event has suddenly entered upon the universes, a superior force. This man and what he can do is an event of force majeure. It changes the way things were. It determines how the future will be. I am a man of war. You are diplomats. You have it in your power, as of this moment, to exert an influence on this force majeure. If you do not avail yourselves of it, you are not diplomats but fools, and suicidal fools at that.
How can we control this?
Said a small lord at the back. Johnny gently guided Sir Robert to the side. It had not gone as planned. Sir Robert had his own ideas. But Sir Robert had actually done very well. They were listening. Before the platforms fired, said Johnny, a conference of emissaries would be called. Any unjustness in the action, any mistaken idea, could be handled. He saw he had some interest. The platforms could operate as an arm of such a conference as this, he said. He could see them sorting it out. He could see that at least some of them were edging toward the idea that this might give them, as individuals, a new power in their governments. It was in their manner. They were not speculating on him, but on themselves. They were looking down at their fingers or talons. They were casting their heads to one side or another. But he knew he didn't have them yet.
It's still an awesome threat, said one.
It solves nothing in our economies, said another. On the contrary, it will produce chaos.
Johnny looked at them. Then he began to realize what he was really dealing with. Every one of these lords and all their peoples had been bred for eons in the shadow of the cruel and sadistic Cyclos. They may have remained politically free, but they were stamped with the Cyclo philosophy. All beings are just animals. Greed, profit, and corruption were understood to be the nature of every individual. There were no decencies or virtues. The brand of the Cyclo. Such sentiments were the ideas of madmen. The Cyclos had tailor-made life this way, and had then said, "See, this is the way life is." How could he reach these mighty lords?
"Our industries," another cried, "are geared to war. An intergalactic peace would ruin us every one."
Yes, thought Johnny. The Cyclos wanted any they did business with at war with one another. Who cared what these free planets did so long as they bought metal? The Cyclos could crush them at any time. The Cyclos wanted them fighting like animals, believed they were only animals. Johnny said, "There are other ways of handling economies. You could phase every war industry you have over to what is called consumer production. You make things for the people. The people are employed. They make things for one another. Your people are your best market for your industries. In the near future, there will be cross-shipping between your worlds. The Cyclos had it worked out that everything was first shipped to Cyclo. By that very fact, they throttled trade. It will be worked out so that you can quickly and cheaply exchange goods from one system to another. Out of that alone will come prosperity. Your people, now starving and rioting, can become gainfully employed in peace industries. They can have things for themselves, such things as better houses and furniture, better clothes, better food. You have a golden chance here to herald an age of prosperity and plenty." He wasn't quite reaching them. They were listening, which was all you could say.
"That doesn't handle riots going on right now," said Dom.
Johnny looked at him. Now for the big plunge that would make Voraz shudder. "I am sure the Galactic Bank would be pleased to make huge and ample loans to governments that would use the money to buy food for their peoples and tide them over to a time when peacetime industry could be phased in. That, and the news of no war again, would halt your riots and stabilize your governments." Browl looked at Voraz.
"Would you do that?"
Voraz found he had McAdam on one side of him and the Baron on the other. They both were jabbing him to say yes. He just sat there. Johnny was talking again. "And I'm sure the bank would make available all necessary loans to convert your industries over to consumer production. Not only that, I'm quite sure that the bank would engage in making loans to the private sector, to small businesses, and even to individuals, so they could purchase new products." Voraz ignored the jabs he was getting. He was looking at Johnny. This young man was talking about commercial banking, a thing usually relegated to petty little stalls on streets, a half credit here and a quarter credit there sort of thing. Johnny went on. "And I also wish to inform you that many new planets will be on the market. You will be able to borrow money to buy them and ample funds to colonize them with what you now consider excess population." Johnny raised his voice a bit and spoke very levelly at Voraz. "Isn't that correct, Lord Voraz?" The head of the Galactic Bank felt like he was in a tidal wave. He hadn't really agreed he would let this young man set bank policy. Should he get up and denounce it? The Galactic Bank had dealt with nations. Then suddenly he realized they had depended upon the Cyclos. Voraz thought furiously. The bankers of the Gradiades knew how to do these things. He thought of their own vast population, much of it always unemployed. Suddenly he had a vision of small offices of the Galactic Bank springing up in every town, every continent, every planet, manned with Salachis. Neighborhood banks, lending money to small businesses and all comers, even employees. Hadn't they done that once, before Lord Lunger?
Yes, he recalled. It would employ an awful lot of Salachis. And these planets to colonize, lending money to them. He was abruptly hit with the fact that he would have to do something with 1,200,000 planets. They couldn't just sit and trust idle. And getting them into production would keep pace with the money supply so as to avoid inflation. This young man was trying to get these excess assets busy. But, he protested to himself, this idea of lending money to governments so they could buy food for their people and just give it away, that was social banking. It was not unknown, but this phase-over period he was talking about would be long. These governments would be in debt up to their gills. Suddenly, Lord Vorash shot an awed look at Johnny. Did he really know what he was doing to these haughty lords and their governments, if they approved it all? Yes, he could see it in his eyes. He did.
Answer, Vorash, said Brow. Is it true you would do these things and on that scale?
Vorash stood up.
My lords, it so happens that the Galactic Bank has just come into possession of assets 1,000 or more times greater than anything it ever controlled before. It will be necessary to put those assets to work. You have all been good credit risks. The answer is yes. With the proper papers and formalities and commitments, the Galactic Bank stands prepared to make those loans as described.
The lords sat for a while. This expansion of policy was very sweeping. And now, my lords, said Johnny, could we discuss this treaty of intergalactic peace? They were hesitating. Worse, some of them looked negative. Mr. Tsung's quote flicked through his mind. The power of money and gold over the souls of men passes all wondering. These were not men, but it fit. Dominated by cyclomaterialism over the long ages, they had come to think like cyclos. He would have to treat them like cyclos, appeal to their personal greed. It was slightly repugnant to his own ethical sense to do what he knew now he would have to do. But there were too many lives, too many civilizations at stake to fail here. Johnny moved to the front of the platform. He knelt down to get his head at the level of theirs. Turn off that spotlight, he called to the back. It died. Turn off all recorders, he barked at the button cameras. They're off, a small, thin voice came back. Johnny looked at the audience. Turn off any recorders you are holding. And to the small gray man, there must be no bank recorders on, and you must so attest. The small gray men tapped their lapels with a twist. We attest they are off. He certainly had their attention now. They were riveted. Johnny turned his head to the lords. In a conspiratorial tone that they had to strain forward to hear, he said, You didn't think I would leave each one of you personally out of this, did you? They were very alert. What do your major firms manufacture? Whispered Johnny. Armaments, came whispering back. And what do you think will happen to interests in those firms, to their stocks and bonds? The lords wondered that he didn't know.
They'll crash.
Precisely, said Johnny, still whispering. Let me tell you what this is really all about. If you went home and talked loudly and widely about a treaty forbidding all war, the stocks and bonds and interests in those armaments firms would go out the bottom. And if, without mentioning yet any plans to convert those firms to consumer products, or the promises of the bank to make adequate loans, you and your friends let those armaments firms crash and then bought up all their shares and interests, possibly even with loans from the bank, you would own them utterly. Meanwhile, you would be heroes to the people for giving them money for food, and the rioting would stop. Then, when you were fully in control, the bank would make conversion loans. Those firms would boom. The merely wealthy would become millionaires.
the millionaires would become billionaires. He crouched there for a moment longer. Then he said, "You must forget that I mentioned this or even spoke of it." He stood up. He waited. Had he been wrong? He couldn't be. Their thinking had been conditioned too long by the oppression of the cyclos. They began to buzz to one another. Then there was a little tittering laugh behind one hand, a drawing closer together of heads. Whispered remarks began to drift up to Johnny. "I can get a new mistress. My wife always hated that old castle. I won't have to sell my yacht." Their heads were together again, whispering. Johnny couldn't make it out. Then, suddenly, Faljapan stood up among the mob. "Lord Johnny, we have forgotten what you said. None of it will be repeated by us." Faljapan seemed to grow in size. "Build your platforms. We are going to write the toughest, claw-proof, iron-hard, most vicious anti-war treaty you have ever heard of." He turned toward the back. "Turn on the lights. Turn on the recorders." Almost as one being, the audience stood. They began to shout, "Long live Lord Johnny! Long live Lord Johnny!" The applause was enough to knock one down. Colonel Ivan let out a gusty sigh of relief and took his finger off his gun trigger. Then he hastily formed up troopers in a zone of protection to get Johnny out of there and back to the small meeting room. These lords were pounding Johnny on the back, almost knocking him down. Bedlam. He didn't know what Johnny had said or how he had turned it around. He didn't speculate. He just concentrated on getting Johnny out of there before they smashed him with good intentions. Knowing Johnny, the reversal did not surprise him. That was life living around Johnny Goodboy Tyler. 4. The Russians had gotten them safely back to the small meeting room, and they had seated themselves once more. Dry's glotten was almost purring as he verified the wording and signatures of the transfer check from the intergalactic held funds over to his bank. It was not the biggest check he had ever heard of, but it was the biggest that had ever come to deposit in his branch bank. And it wasn't just a check. It meant solvency, reopened doors in the lesser sector offices, employees back on the job. Actually, he didn't have to verify it at all. He knew it was good, but he just liked to read it. With a flourish, he drew the receipt to him. With an expert flip of his hand, he signed it. And then he picked up the mortgage papers, and with great big letters scrawled across it, wrote, "Paid in full." My, but this was worth all those worried months of waiting. He put the check safely in his pocket and then sailed the receipt and papers with a gay spin back to McAdam. "Our business is finished. It is a pleasure to do business with you." But as he let go his grip on McAdam's hand, Dry saw Lord Voraz was still sitting there, staring blankly at the table. An instant of alarm touched Dry's. "Your worship, is something wrong?" Voraz turned to him. Ignoring Johnny's presence, such was his preoccupation, Voraz said, "Didn't you understand what he did?" Dry said, "Speculative loans? The lords will try to borrow money to get those shares when they crash. But that is a small matter. Those loans will be good." "No, no," said Voraz. "What he is doing to those lords and their governments." "No, you don't see. Let me explain. By providing widespread employment, and by making it possible for the little creature on the street to borrow money, he is creating an independent working class. In years to come, they won't have to stand around cap in hand. They will become financially independent. The state will depend on them as a market and not be able to neglect them anymore. And huge quantities of bank business will be with that working class."
"I see nothing wrong in that," said Dries. "With all the money those governments will owe us, they'll have to do pretty much what the bank tells them."
"That's just it," said Voraz.
and the bank will tell them more and more to pay attention to the working class, because that's where the bank's main interest lies. Those lords and their existing governments will have less and less power. To all intents and purposes, they will vanish as a special class.
Ah, said Dries, remembering his school days. Social banking.
Johnny lounged back in his chair at the side. He was a little bit spent. He wished they'd finish up. It's called social democracy, he said. It will work as long as there are lots of new frontiers and room to expand. But we have those, and in a few thousand years, somebody can think of something else. Voraz was looking at McAdam and the Baron now.
Do you know what he just did? In that short period, in that room in there, he freed more people than have been freed in all the revolutions in history.
I knew he gave us the power to hold those lords in check, said McAdam. Shall we finish this bank resolution so we can end this conference?
Voraz came out of it. He picked up a proxy.
This mentions a second resolution.
The Baron came to life.
That's about Lord Lunga.
Yes, said Voraz. How long has he been dead now? 200?
Listen, said the Baron. The Cyclos are about the most hated people any universe ever saw. A couple of 100,000 years ago, your Lord Lunga saved them with the bank. Today, that's not a very popular act.
Indeed not, said Voraz.
The Baron said, the definition of money is an idea backed with confidence. It isn't helping your money any to have Lord Lunga's face on all your banknotes.
Johnny suddenly stirred. A premonition based on what had happened with Earth money hit him. He was about to speak. Sir Robert's huge hand closed over his mouth and silenced him. Dries had been looking at Johnny for the last minute. Without taking his eyes off him, Dries said,
Your Worship, has it occurred to you that this young man could be part Salachi?
There was no humor in his voice at all. Johnny was absolutely glaring at them above Sir Robert's big hand. He wouldn't fight Sir Robert, but he really had his eyes boring into the rest of them.
It's his eyes, said Dries. They've got gray in them. Another color, yes, somewhat like the sea. But look at those eyes. Gray.
I certainly see what you mean, said Lord Voraz. He does resemble a Salachi.
I have several picto recordings of him, said Dries, from a lot of angles. We can get that painter, Rensfin, to use them and make an idealized portrait. With the helmet in color. There is a special ink that can make the buttons flash, and we can do the helmet in full color, three-dimensional view. But what should be put on the scroll? Johnny Goodboy Tyler, conqueror of the Cyclos?
No, no, said Voraz. Who brought freedom from war? Said the Baron.
No, no, said Voraz. That word freedom would antagonize lords and such.
We have to have this really good and final, you know, for we'll be reprinting all currency and retiring all old issues everywhere. We have to add along the bottom, backed by the assets of the Earth Planetary Bank and Intergalactic Mining, or something like that. We can make the picture a bit larger in the center, but the wording...
He trailed off. McAdam brightened.
We've got to get in there what he did. The painter should put in the background a picture of Cyclo exploding, and on the scroll we can put Johnny Goodboy Tyler, and right under that put Who Brought Happiness to All Races.
The very thing, said Voraz. It doesn't relegate it to just destroying Cyclo, because that isn't all he really did. People will know fast enough. His popularity will be not just in the stars, but all over the stars and planets in 16 universes.
Lord Voraz sat forward and drew the resolution to him. He penned in the wording for the banknote. And then he shot his cuffs, raised his pen in a flourish, and signed the resolutions. It was all finished. The small gray men got up. They were all beaming smiles. Sir Robert let go of a morose Johnny, and they shook hands all around.
"I think," said Voraz to McAdam and the Baron, "that we can work together splendidly. It is banking right after my own heart."
They laughed. The small gray men gathered their papers and left.
"Wee-hoo and woof,"
said McAdam, grinning from ear to ear.
"We're free and clear and sailing like birds."
He looked at Johnny.
"Thanks in no small part to you, laddie."
5. McAdam and Baron von Roth were picking up their papers, admiring the signatures, getting ready to leave. Johnny said, "How did you get those directors in Snouch to pay enough attention to you to listen?" The Baron boomed a laugh.
"It was the way we started our account. It went all through the bank in seconds. Since the Cyclos hogged it, and it was already scarce, gold in the Gradides is soaring at 500,000 credits an ounce. We opened our account with gold. Your gold, Johnny. Near a ton of it. We melted it into ingots some time ago. Almost broke our back lugging it into the bank. They hadn't seen that much gold in a century."
Johnny laughed. "So even Turl's gold came in handy."
"After all that work at the load," said McAdam, "that gold belonged to you and the crews. We'll bring it home if you want, but it's on exhibit right this minute, behind armored glass, in what's left of the main foyer of the Galactic Bank and Snouch. Historic gold, Johnny."
"Another thing," said Johnny. "What did you do with Care that got him to sign those papers?"
"Care?" said the Baron. "Well, for one thing, he is your friend, Johnny, and we said it would help you. But Stormalong saw your views of Cyclodes at night, and he told Care it was one dead planet. You never saw such relief. He's always felt hunted by them. So, as the last official planet head, he even had his appointment papers, and they're attached to the deed. He was really glad to be rid of it. They promised him a standard employment contract, minus the clause to ship the body home. They let him keep the few 100,000 credits he hooked out of the loot of his predecessor, and guaranteed him breathe gas for the rest of his life. I hope we can fulfill the latter."
Johnny thought of the moon Phobia. Yes, they could pump tons of it into bottles with the transshipment rig. No pain, easy. Johnny watched them packing up and then said, "You two certainly did a brilliant job. Really extraordinary." They grinned at him.
"We had a good example. You."
"But," said Johnny, "how did you know to word that intergalactic sale contract that way for Turl to sign?" McAdam laughed.
"When Brown Limper Stafford tried to use it to secure his new currency issue, we saw that it wasn't a legal contract. Turl had even tried to forge his own signature."
He had a copy of the original, and it was a ridiculous mess.
"So the Baron and I got to thinking. It had been nearly 11 months since you sent those bombs to Cyclo, and there had been no counterattack. If Cyclo were gone, then according to Care, there wasn't much chance of other mining planets having enough breathe gas left. They'd all be dead."
"So," said the Baron, "we took a banker's chance and worded it so that it was valid either way."
"And there's one additional reason," said McAdam, "knowing how you operate. If you set out to destroy Cyclo, which you did, we put our bets on the fact that you had really done it. And we were right. You can't go very wrong putting your chips on Johnny," said the Baron.
He hitched a stack of documents under his arm and picked up a bulging briefcase, looking around to see if they had everything.
"Then, they're all set." "Oh, no, we're not,"
said Sir Robert. His tone was so positive and censorious that they stopped and looked at him, startled.
I think, said Sir Robert, that it's a wee bit disgraceful the way you use this poor lad.
I don't understand, said McAdam, shocked.
You use his picture on Earth currency? You use his energy and ideas to further your own ends? You own the bulk of 16 universes? You're now plotting to put his face on galactic money? And here he is, poor as a church mouse. Why, he doesn't even collect his own pilot pay that I know of. I know you're going to lend him money for a factory, but what's that? Just a plan to get him in debt? You should be ashamed of yourselves.
And he meant it. He couldn't have had more effect on McAdam and the Baron if he'd shot them with a stun gun. Johnny had tried to stop Sir Robert the moment he had gotten an inkling of what the old Scot was saying. Johnny didn't think he needed any money. If he was hungry, he could always go out and hunt. But Sir Robert's hand had stopped him. The Baron looked at McAdam, and McAdam looked at the Baron. Clearly, they were two very puzzled men. Sir Robert just kept on glaring at them. It was very uncomfortable. Finally, Sir Robert said,
You might at least give him a little payment for using his picture.
Suddenly, a light seemed to dawn on McAdam's face. He dropped his bundled documents on the table and began to rifle through a near-bursting attaché case. He found what he was looking for and, holding it, sat in a chair before them.
Oh, Johnny, Johnny, please forgive us. It is plain you don't know.
He began to open up some documents.
Then you never mentioned it, said the Baron. We thought you didn't want it known.
McAdam was holding out the information announcement of the charter of the bank.
The Earth Planetary Bank was chartered by the original, valid, 30 Chief Council. This was the information sheet that was released about it.
He took the second document he held and opened it. But this is the actual charter as passed.
The actual charter is the only one valid under law, and the Baron and I have wondered many times why they were different. But do you remember who was sometimes acting as secretary of the original council?
The information sheet on the charter mentioned only McAdam and Baron von Roth. The Baron and McAdam looked at each other, and in chorus said,
Brown Limper Stafford?
For reasons of his own, said McAdam, he miscopied the resolution for public release. We stupidly thought you didn't want it disclosed.
He opened up the original charter, and there at the top, ahead of the names of Baron von Roth and Andrew McAdam, was the name, bright and clear, Johnny Goodboy Tyler.
Haven't you ever noticed we always tried to ask your opinion of any big deals?
Pleaded the Baron, very contrite.
You were doing so many things more important that we just carried on, said McAdam. But Sir Robert, this lad is the owner of a third part of the Planetary Bank by charter?
The Baron said to Sir Robert, Johnny now owns 2/9, or about 22% of the Galactic Bank, and 1/3 of Intergalactic Mining Company.
He turned to McAdam.
Maybe we should make it more.
McAdam looked at Sir Robert.
Did you think we would leave the poor lad, as you call him, out in the cold? He also owns part of that ton of gold, and altogether, you'd need a computer to add up his money. It's in the quintillions. He's the richest poor lad these 16 universes have ever seen, including the late Emperor of Cyclo.
Sir Robert let go of Johnny and suddenly began to laugh. He punched Johnny in the shoulder.
Get along with you, you church mouse in disguise.
He looked at the others.
Aye, gentlemen, I'll let it be and see enough's enough. Just barely, mind, just barely. See, he added, maybe you should go out there and buy him 6 of those fancy lords for his gillies.
He already bought them, said McAdam, down to the last bauble in their boots.
All but Johnny boomed out laughter. His head was going round. Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 13, Side 2. All but Johnny boomed out laughter. His head was going round. Quintillions? The number was unreal. Maybe he could buy one of those woven leather lead ropes for Windsplitter, or buy some new furniture if Chrissy had lost all hers. The thought of Chrissy hit him. He had been keeping it suppressed so he could keep on going. McAdam and the Baron collected up their things again and walked out, shaking their heads and muttering, "Brown limper," and "Made trouble clear to the end." A wailing, petulant voice cut into the room, and Sir Robert looked up. Stormalong was behind two Russians at the room entrance, who were stolidly blocking him out of it.
"Sir Robert, please come out here. I've had a dispatch that's been waiting for you for hours and hours and hours."
Sir Robert pushed past the Russian guards and vanished. Johnny sat there, a little bit spent, trying to get oriented to what the rush of events added up to, trying to decide what he should do now. He made up his mind. Nothing was holding him here. He would go out and get a plane and get to Scotland to help. He grabbed his helmet off the floor. The two Russians at the door parted to let him through. He collided with Sir Robert. The old Scot was standing there, a written message in his hand. He was crying and laughing all at the same time. Sir Robert pushed the dispatch into Johnny's hand.
"Ah, weel, 'tis quite a mess. But Johnny, the old rock protected them all."
Edinburgh. They had gotten through the last tunnel at dawn today. They were half-starved, some injured, all in a state of greater or lesser shock, but they had gotten them out, all 2,100 of them. Johnny felt dazed with relief. There were no specific names mentioned in the radio dispatch. He stumbled out into the bowl, meaning to go to ops. There was someone across the bowl, someone covered with dust but wearing the domed helmet they used in high-speed flying. It was Thor. Thor was beckoning to him gladly. Thor shouted,
"Look who we got here for you, Johnny!"
Somebody was rushing toward him. She threw her arms about him, crying his name. It was Chrissy, gaunt and pale, her black eyes flooding with tears.
"Oh, Johnny, she was saying, "I'm never going to leave you again. Never. Hold me, Johnny."
Johnny did. He just stood there, almost crushing her ribs. He held her for a long time. He couldn't talk. Chapter 31. 1. Johnny was riding Windsplitter along the banks of the Alzette River in Luxembourg. He was leisurely wending his way home. It was a lovely summer day. The sunlight spattered down through the leafy trees along the trail, making patterns of green and gold that shifted gently and seemed to slowly echo the soft music of the purling stream. Windsplitter snorted and tried to rear. It was the bear. The same bear they had seen there several times during the 3 months they had been in Luxembourg, using this same trail from the old mine site to Johnny's house. The bear was fishing. He stopped now and tested the environment with his nose and saw them. He was a pretty big bear, brown, about 6.5 feet tall as he stood up. "It's just the bear, you old fraud," said Johnny. Windsplitter sort of laughed and settled down. He did what he could to make life more exciting. And ever since the horses had been flown down from Russia, they had been getting fat from idleness. Johnny always rode him down to the mine site, mornings, and left him to poke around the strange doings there until Johnny rode home. Just now he would have been far happier with a good old flat-out run through these interesting summer-dressed woods. But he stood still, obedient to a heel command. Johnny sat and idly watched the bear. It had resumed its fishing, seeing no menace in the horse and rider on the other bank of the shallow stream. Johnny bet if he had been a cyclo, that bear would have left the country.
and would have still been running all the next day. Johnny indifferently wanted to see if the bear would catch any of the big trout with which the stream abounded. For all this beautiful day, Johnny had a small feeling of disappointment. He had awakened that morning with the odd conviction that this new day was going to bring something really eventful, some piece of good news, and all day he had been anticipating it. He reviewed what had happened so far to see if any bright event had been missed by him. He had gone, pretty much as usual, down to the old mine site to find the routine bedlam in progress. 3 months ago, he had bought the old Grand Duchy of Luxembourg from the Intergalactic Holdings. The Cyclos had had an iron mine there, which they had worked in a lackadaisical fashion. They had also built a small steel mill and a forge, which they used to turn out hooks, ore buckets, and such for their mines on Earth. The invaders had not touched the place, already well defended, and the deep underground levels had been ideal for doing the final setup of consoles. Angus McTavish and Tom Smiley Townsend worked there, behind vault doors. They had streamlined assembly, so all they had to do was implant the pattern of the circuit on the insulating board, assemble the console, and shove it into a shipping case. Everything else was pre-constructed, practically out in the open, since it gave away nothing. In fact, nobody but Johnny, Angus, Tom Smiley, and Sir Robert knew that the consoles were completed at Luxembourg. The pre-assembly even included boxing. People who did it thought Angus and Tom Smiley were just inspectors. But these two, working only a couple of hours a day, using designed patterns and tools, withdrew the pre-constructed console out of the case, finished it, sealed it, and then lined it up in the rows of them. A heavily guarded convoy of trucks then drove them an incredible distance down to an ancient tunnel, once called St. Gotthard, about 9 miles long. There, the boxes were unloaded onto mine platform cars and sent on the ancient rails to the tunnel center. An automatic machine stamped them completed as they were passed through a blocked chamber and put them onto a new set of mine platform cars. A brand new set of trucks, much more heavily guarded, then rushed them to the new firing platform that was now located in a mountain bowl outside Zurich. There, they were routed and shipped. As Johnny, Angus, and Tom Smiley had set up the tunnel, and as it was heavily gunned and guarded, nobody knew who did the final assembly. Some thought there were special personnel or gnomes or something that lived in that tunnel and did the work. They were batting out about 200 consoles a day. The pre-assembly people were making the whole platform and poles and wiring, since none of that was secret, and they were being shipped right along with the consoles. No, mused Johnny. There was nothing startlingly new in all that today. It was last week when Tom Smiley had told him Margarita was going to have a baby. The bear had gotten his first trout. He batted it way up on the bank, looked around, and then went back to fishing. Windsplitter had found some young grass and was noisily pulling it up and eating it. There had been nothing new with the Chatavarians. The bank had informed Sir Robert the moment all arms and related firms had crashed, but good in the Chatavarian Empire, and Sir Robert and Angus and half a dozen Salachis had sped there. The Chatavarians had the reputation of being the best defense builders. It was their boast that no cyclo attack had ever broken through in an entire 700-planet empire. They had even shot down gas drones. So, for that and other reasons, the new teleportation company, now called the Rig Industry, after Johnny rejected using his name on it, had done business with the Chatavarians. The Salachis had helped Angus find the right companies and had helped Sir Robert do the purchasing, and they now owned 11 Chatavarian firms, each one specialized in what they needed. There had been no dearth of firms for sale, and no lack of engineers and workers in that heavily overpopulated empire, 49 trillion. They had left the main offices in Chatavaria, and only working sections were here. No, there had been no good news about all that. Rather, a bit of bad news. The main offices of those firms were costly to maintain as they couldn't fire key staff there. and the problem of what they should now manufacture at home was coming up. Their technology and ability were good. Johnny had a little trouble with their math. They used a binary system, as everything they had ran on computers and circuits. But everything they built was just great, with one exception. Johnny could not abide reaction engines. Flying one was a drag, and they required special runways and pads to land. They were fine out in space, but not for atmosphere transport. You couldn't even stunt them, really. The Chatavarians themselves were all over the place at Luxembourg. They were nice people. They stood about 5 feet tall, had somewhat flat heads and big buck teeth. They were a bright orange tan. Their hands were a trifle webbed, but very nimble, and they were strong. Johnny had found that out when he was fooling around wrestling with one of their engineers. Johnny had come within an ace of not being able to throw him. And they were always going fast. Work, work, work. They ate wood, and the first thing they did when their crews arrived was plant about 15,000 acres of assorted trees, planted with the speed of machine guns into what they called catalyst pots. This was so they could have something to eat. They had a bit of conflict with the three Chinese engineers that were here. The Chinese liked to build out of wood, and the Chatavarians thought that was an awful waste of good food. The Chatavarians loved to work with stone. They had small beam tools, like swords, and they cut stone with splice notches so it would hang together with no mortar. Then they annealed the stone and made it join molecularly so it was armor hard, and the whole grain of the stone came out in bright, glossy colors. Very pretty. They taught the Chinese how to do it, and the Chinese taught them how to weave silk, so all was forgiven, and it came out with smiles. But it was touchy for a while. Going to a Chatavarian dinner was like walking into a lumber yard. Johnny had to make them promise not to gnaw down all the trees in sight. The Chatavarians tended to overstaff, and unless Johnny dreamed up some consumer product for the home offices to build, the red ink on their balance sheets would splash into blood. He wanted to get them building teleportation motor cars and planes, but he didn't know how to make a teleportation motor, and all efforts to work it out failed. Those blasted cyclomathematics. Nothing ever balanced. The thought made him restless. The bear had caught another fish. The sunlight played over Johnny's buckskin shirt. He had been sure something nice would happen today. Well, the day wasn't over. He touched Windsplitter's shoulder, and the horse decided it was a signal to run, which it wasn't, and went tearing up the trail for home. 2. They burst out of the forest and rushed toward the palace, and then Windsplitter made a huge show of how hard it was to stop. It wasn't, and reared and pawed the air. "Show off," Johnny accused him. It hadn't been all that much of a run, only half a mile, but Windsplitter was content. The row that was going on in the middle of the 10-acre lawn attracted him. Stormy, the lame Blodgett's colt, he looked just like Windsplitter, even with his much too long legs, and a huge tan dog that had recently trotted out of the forest and adopted Chrissy were romping and plunging and racing away and pretending to stomp and bite, always missing. Blodgett was looking on without much concern, and Windsplitter walked over to her. Johnny slid off and raised his hand to the Russian in the control turret, hidden in the right-hand tower. A flick of a white sleeve as the guard waved back. This place had really changed. The only trouble with it was, it looked too new and shiny, and it certainly now would never age. The Chinese engineers had understood, but the Chatavarians just couldn't grasp that a place should show a little age. Johnny remembered when Chrissy had first spotted the place. They were in a small plane, and Johnny, having just bought the duchy, was trying to get some idea of its layout. Chrissy had all of a sudden leaned out the window and shouted, "There! There! There!" And nothing would do but that he land and let her look at the place. She had still been gaunt, and he couldn't refuse her much. The building had stood in the middle of a wilderness that might have once been parks. Hard to tell. hard to tell even that the piled ruin of stone had ever been much but rocks. Chrissy had raced around, heedless of the briars that plucked at her buckskin leggings, shouting back at him in wild excitement. She pointed to a 50-acre plot, crying, "And that's just the place for a cattle yard," and to another place, "Ideal for your horses," and spreading her arms, indicating some pits, "Perfect for tanning vats." And then tracing a stream that was bubbling along, minding its own business, "And this can be diverted to run right by the kitchen door, and we can have running water all the time." She had gone tearing around on the cracked remains of what might have been room floors, and pointed to outlines Johnny could not see. "A fireplace here, and one here, and another there." Then she had stood in front of him and said, "Here we will never be hungry. We will never be snowed in. We will never be cold." And then, defiantly, as though he might say no, "This is where we are going to live." Johnny got the Chatavarian chief engineer who had arrived with the 200 Chatavarian first construction contingent and told him to build something modern on the site. He thought he was rid of the problem, but the following day he found himself confronted by a very irate Chatavarian architectural team. When the Chatavarian became incensed, he sort of whistled through his teeth, quite distinct from the gurgling sound, like air coming up through a water bottle, when they laughed. The leading architect was whistling his indignation. It didn't matter whether Johnny owned the company, but Johnny was really a Chatavarian, proven by the fact that he had his title direct from the Empress Beaz. And he had to be told that he should know better. Completely at sea, Johnny was treated to a dissertation on architecture. They had studied earth forms, and many were all right. Classic Greek and Roman were known in other systems, and if impractical, were still acceptable. Gothic, neo-Gothic, and Renaissance architecture, they actually thought quite novel. They could even strain their artistic sensibilities by going along with Baroque. But modern? They quit. Send them back to Chatavaria. Send them back even though they would starve there. Some things one just couldn't do. It was only then that Johnny found that modern had been a type of architecture prevalent on Earth about 1,100 years ago, that it consisted of plain, straight up and down walls on a rectangular base, that it often was a vast expanse of glass windows, that it had been conceived by somebody dedicated to stamping out all indigenous architecture of an area. In short, modern was an architecture that wasn't architecture, but just a cheap way to throw rubbish in the air and get paid for it. The Chatavarian, with a quivering, pointing finger in the direction of the old city of Luxembourg, and backed up by the serious nods of five assistants, wailed that that whole town had been built in modern, and on his artistic soul no such abominations would be perpetuated while he lived. Johnny had apologized. The Chatavarian said maybe it came from having to talk in cyclo, and Johnny asked what they recommended. Five assistants presented a huge plan instantly. This building, they said, had been the palace of the Grand Duke of Luxembourg in ancient times, and even though Johnny did not think so, he didn't say so. The indigenous architecture, from the castles that lay about, probably had been Gothic and neo-Gothic, and this palace should be like this. Johnny had delayed long enough to ask Chrissy, but all she gave him were the items she had found that made the place charming, and he had made sure those were included and had told them to go ahead. Chrissy and he had camped out in the woods, happy to be away from the din, cheerful in a buckskin tent, and eating good food cooked on an open fire. The Chatavarians had cleared the site and erected an armor steel shell. They had then flown down to a couple of marble quarries north of Leghorn in Italy and operated a ferry of ore freighters until they had piles of green and rose and other colored slabs. They had spliced them together into an exterior and interior of polished, armored rock. They had underplated the stream so that it did what it was supposed to do. But they had also installed full plumbing. The fireplaces would burn wood, but since this was a waste of good food, they also put solar-driven infra-heaters in them and a simulated flame. It was a palace, all right, and it might be Gothic, but it sure was colorful. Chrissy had been enthralled with it. Johnny, as he walked to the arches on the other side of the drawbridge, could hear in the distance the crash and bang of the Chataverians ripping the old city of Luxembourg into chips. They had gone through it with historical and artifact survey teams, and then the rams had been turned loose. That was the one piece of modern that would not survive. The bank had already moved back to Zurich, and Johnny would have liked to live there, too, because of the nearby mountains. Johnny halted. Dry's glutton must have been here today, for there was a burn spot in the lawn. Dry's, after turning over his sector branch office, had been appointed Galactic Bank liaison with the Earth Planetary Bank. He had been the finder of the One, but a bank executive couldn't accept such rewards. They would undermine customer confidence, and Voraz had raised Dry's salary to 100,000 credits a year, quite enough to maintain his yacht and anything else. Dry's had left the yacht here and teleported home, and while he was gone, his Salachi crew had been teaching the Chataverians gambling games and winning a lot of their pay. But the Chinese engineers had been winning it back from the Salachis, so Johnny had kept out of it. Dry's rambled all over in his yacht, an oddity to use a spacecraft to go to the corner store for a bottle of schnapps. But that was Dry's. He had taken the job on the condition that he would have long weekends, and he seemed to always be going to northern Scotland. He said he was starting a peppermint industry on the side, but Johnny didn't believe him. He was sure something else was involved. Today he had probably brought Chrissy some butter or something. On the other hand, he might have been settling some accounts with Mr. Tsung. Dry's kept certain customers, and Mr. Tsung was one of them. Johnny's account was cared for by 15 Salachis who worked down at the mine site, and Dry's had nothing to do with that. It ran about $1 trillion a day income now, and was growing. Mr. Tsung's account was, however, somehow interesting to Dry's. Johnny had offered Mr. Tsung a salary, and Mr. Tsung had been very surprised, for he said a chamberlain usually paid his boss, from which Johnny got the explanation of how some guests were always invited and some weren't. But it was Mr. Tsung's daughter that was making money. She was named Lu, after the last empress of the Han Dynasty, and she was becoming famous. She worked in a little pagoda-like structure out back that was really a disguised anti-aircraft pit, and she turned out pictures of tigers in the snow and birds flying and things like that on both silk and rice paper, and they were collector's items, bringing in 1,000 credits at a crack. She also worked around the house and helped Chrissy and cut hair. Johnny decided he'd better have a metal pad installed for Dry's to land on. He got along fine with him now. No use to tell him off. He couldn't get through the courtyard. Lin Lee, Mr. Tsung's son-in-law, had all the banquet hall furniture out and was working it over with molecular metal spray. The young man had an audience of a couple of awed Chataverians. He could paint pictures freehand with a metal spray gun and a piece of cardboard to catch the splatters. He was very quick. Right now he was doing a scene Johnny knew he must have gotten from pictures of tapestries, a lot of nights. He was putting it on the huge banquet tabletop. He had stopped doing dragon medallions by hand. As they were all the same, a couple of Chataverian mechanics, awed by his ability, had gotten him to do a perfect one, and then had made a machine to turn them out at about 10,000 an hour. The demand out in the universe was such that they were back-ordered even so. Johnny couldn't get through without interrupting Lin Lee. So he stood there watching. Chrissy and Mr. Tsung had been talking about the possibility of some of these Chataverians getting out of hand at a party and eating up the furniture. That must be what this metal plating was all about. They had to suit the dwelling to the many guests they always had. The vague feeling of disappointment hit him again. He had been certain, when he rose, that this was a sort of special day, that something wonderful was going to happen. It hadn't. Lin Lee had just started on a ferocious figure of a charging knight. He was using a scarlet metal, putting blood on a blade. It made Johnny think of the red ink coming in so far on the Chataverian Company Desperation Defense. If he could just unravel motors, he could put them over into passenger transport. But he was condemned if he would continue with reaction engines. Lin Lee was guiding the molecular spray, now gray, to make the armor. The Chataverians were looking on with awe. One of them was holding a spare gun, ready to hand it to Lin Lee. They weren't assistants. They just wished they could do things like that. The Chataverian closed the trigger of the gun to test it. Suddenly, Johnny knew it had happened. The nice thing. He sped back out the arch and raced all around the palace side and jumped the creek and popped into the back door. Chrissy, hair tied back, was filling a big bowl held by Mr. Tsung from a pot on the fire. "Chrissy," said Johnny, "get your things." Patty was sitting over in the corner. Patty never said anything these days. She just looked down. Tinny, the Buddhist communicator, had been trying to talk to her, as she often did. "Tinny," said Johnny, "call the mine site. Get me a marine attack plane on the pad in 20 minutes. Call Dr. McKendrick in Aberdeen and tell him to come right away to Victoria."
"Patty doesn't feel well," said Chrissy.
"Bring her along," said Johnny.
"Is it a diplomatic conference or a scientific one?" said Mr. Tsung, monotone through the vocoder.
"Medical," said Johnny. Mr. Tsung put down the bowl and raced off to put a white coat and a pair of spectacles, which had no glass in them, in a sack. That was proper dress he had seen in ancient pictures.
"Johnny," said Chrissy, "this is venison stew."
"We'll eat it on the plane. We're headed for Africa." 3. Johnny headed the marine attack plane slightly east of south and turned on his view screens. This co-pilot was new, from the French refugees in the Alps, named Pierre Solon. He was quite young, recently trained. He still had a little trouble speaking Cyclo. Usually, his duties consisted of simply shifting the mineside planes about, but as compound duty pilot, it had been up to him to deliver the ship to Johnny's house. He had not dreamed that in the next few minutes, he would be flying co-pilot to the Tyler and heading for Africa. He had started out all right, but when he saw how Johnny took off, he had become overawed. He had never seen a plane lofted that way, like firing a bullet. And now they were flying hypersonic at only 15,000 feet. Would they clear the French and Italian Alps?
"We are awfully low," he timidly offered.
"People in back," said Johnny. "Can't let them get too cold. Get to work with those view screens so we won't be running into any drones." Drones, drones, drones. All his life, Johnny had been being looked at by drones. It was no exception now. The Chataverian defense system was only half complete. Despite buying the company, it was an expensive system, almost three times as costly as the one the small gray men had described, but it was about 10 times as good. Automatic blast cannon that fired 1,500 miles into space could shoot down a space fleet with one salvo. Atmosphere drones that fired. Space drones that patrolled orbits. Probes that scanned anything moving within 10 light-years. Real armor cable that would make every city untouchable. As the system was incomplete, a lot of emergency stand-in drones were about, and they were attracted to anything flying. A huge green flashing light was going on top of the plane, and the box there, newly installed, was sending out the code of the day, which was so fast and so scrambled and changing microsecond to microsecond that an attacker could not hope to duplicate it. If the drones didn't see and hear it, they'd shoot. Ah, yes, here came the Mediterranean emergency drones, 3 of them, shooting over to have a look. The co-pilot was slow, and Johnny tuned a knob to focus them. Chataverian drones, all right. Each one had a big eye painted on its nose. But those big, staring eyes were not a Chataverian fixation on decoration. A pilot would instinctively shoot into the center of them, and if a pilot did, The drone used the shot as a return carrier wave to send a surge back that blew up the attacker's own ammunition and thereby his ship. Don't shoot at one of those eyes. Nevertheless, they were a bit disconcerting, glaring out of the view screen. They nudged in like sniffing dogs, and then, satisfied by automatically cross-verifying with each other, they fell away and returned to their patrol sectors. The French pilot was looking back at the Alps. They hadn't hit any. But Johnny had his screens on the orbit drones now. They seemed to be disinterested, satisfied by the code of the day. And what was this? He had a space probe on the screen. He hadn't known you could see one. Was it hostile? Like any star drone or probe, these things had a lens that was made of a light magnet. This reacted on light beams and pulled them in from a zone many miles in diameter and concentrated them, magnetically corrected for aberration, into a spot smaller than a dot on paper. In effect, it made a lens many, many miles in diameter. The problem was too much light rather than too little, and they had blinders or filters that dropped into place to keep them from burning out their receivers or recording discs should they turn toward a sun too close. In that way, one could get magnifications into the tens of trillions. One of the contractors had drilled Johnny in on command controls, and a box of these existed overhead. Johnny flipped a switch and tapped the probe's receiver and shifted the image to his own central view screen. It was their own space probe, all right. He was looking at the co-pilot and himself behind their own view screen. Yet that space probe was over 10,000 miles away. It must be at the near end of a run. Friendly, so he threw the tap off. He didn't really think anybody would attack Earth now. The peace treaty had gone in, as promised, with claws. Very, very popular. The delegates had even taken home copies of The End of Cyclo and The Death of Asart. The bank was shoveling out food loans like a waterfall. Consumer products had not yet begun to roll. That would take time. He hoped he could get at the secret of how one built a teleportation motor. That would open the door to a lot of consumer products. And even more important, keep the vehicles they had here operating. These planes wouldn't last forever. Take over, he told the French pilot, Pierre, and went back into the body of the plane. Chrissy stirred herself and unwrapped a bowl.
I'm afraid the venison stew might be cold now.
Johnny sat down in one of the huge bucket seats. Patty was down at the back of the plane, just sitting there, looking down. It worried him. Sometimes she went for walks at night. Sometimes he could hear her in her room crying. Because she was only 10, he had thought she would recover, but she hadn't. Mr. Tsung, he saw, was going to use this time-space to catch up with his diplomatic and social duties. For here he came with about 10 pounds of paper. Johnny put his attention on the stew. It wasn't cold.
This week's dispatch box came in from Snouch, he said.
So that was what Dries was doing coming down from Zurich. Send the business matters down to the mineside office. It's their job.
Oh, I did, said Mr. Tsung. These are all social and diplomatic. Invitations to weddings, banquets, christenings, requests to address meetings.
Well, thank them and tell them no, said Johnny.
Oh, I have, said Mr. Tsung. We don't have any trouble. We use a vocal reader, a vocoder, and a vocotyper. We can handle correspondence in about 18,000 languages now, but this is going to get heavier.
Here it comes, thought Johnny. Mr. Tsung's elder brother had been appointed chamberlain to the court of the chief of Clan Fergus. His younger brother was busy starting up a diplomatic college in Edinburgh. You got another brother? Said Johnny, around a mouthful of stew.
I am sorry that I don't, retorted Mr. Tsung. I'm talking about the nephew of Baron von Roth. He wants to apprentice as a diplomat in my office.
Fine, said Johnny. Mr. Tsung adjusted the vocoder volume higher as the plane was roaring more with Pierre at the console.
I want to hire about 30 more Russian and Chinese girls to train as clerks and vocal typer operators. It's really very simple. One reads invitations with a vocal reader into one's own language, and then one uses a vocoder to talk to the vocal typer, and it types the answer back into the tongue of the original letter.
Go ahead, said Johnny.
I think there should be a new building to take care of all these people and files. Something more on a Chinese...
Go ahead, said Johnny.
There was one letter that I pulled out that you should see, said Mr. Tsung. It's from Lord Voraz to MacAdam with a copy to you, and Dries said MacAdam had to hear from you before he answered.
Trouble, thought Johnny.
Voraz wants a formula to determine the validity of a commercial loan.
That's not diplomatic or social, said Johnny.
It's kind of diplomatic, said Mr. Tsung. Voraz and MacAdam being who they are, one does not wish to see tensions. The whole problem is what consumer products should arms companies convert to. If they convert to the wrong ones, the whole program will fail, and the bank will have granted useless loans.
His own problem in a different dress, thought Johnny. He thought of the red ink of desperation defense.
Intergalactic Mining, said Mr. Tsung, looking at the Voraz letter, was sitting on hundreds of thousands of inventions that were on file in the Hall of Legality to prevent other nations from using them. I know this isn't diplomatic, but it could make a big diplomatic mess if the bank lends money to make the wrong products. Also, all the invention formulas are in Cyclomath.
Johnny had finished the venison stew, and he gave the bowl back to Chrissy. There was something in the old man books about this. What was the subject? Marketing is a factor in profit. You tell MacAdam to have banks get out survey teams, people that go around and ask people questions, and find out what people in each planetary area think they would want to buy. Not what they should buy, but what they want to buy. Don't offer suggestions. Just ask them. For all they know, it might be as little as a... He recalled his own discovery that glass would cut. As something to skin hides more easily. The subject is marketing surveys. And I'm working on Cyclomath right now. Tinny had been listening. She was already punching phone buttons. This was a new system. But it was kind of overdone. The smallest exchange the Chatavarians made for a planet had 2 billion individual radio channels. And since the war, they only had about 31,000 people. There were radio phone printers everywhere. She was on to the Zurich bank, plugging in the recording she had just made of his voice. Tsung saw Johnny wasn't going to say more, and nodded to her, and she let it start. The printed reply would be rolling off onto MacAdam's desk right now. She fed in the reference letter Tsung gave her.
Dries left you this, said Mr. Tsung.
He handed Johnny a little blue disc with a pin on the back of it. It said, Galactic Bank, on the front of it. When he saw Johnny looking at it, but not taking it, he added,
The Chatoverian Deadly Device Officer passed it.
Johnny took it. He give you anything else?
Oh, you know Dries, said Mr. Tsung. He said there was an excess supply of butter up in the highlands now, and he brought Chrissy a whole bucket of it. Some old woman has 15 Holstein cows, and he says he's financing a butter business.
Johnny laughed. There had been no Holstein cows in Scotland that he knew of. Dries must have persuaded a pilot to fly them up from Germany or Switzerland, where they roamed wild. Another peppermint industry. Do we give him anything in return?
Oh, yes, said Mr. Tsung. We always feed him a tub of fried rice. He loves it. And my son-in-law found a book of colored plates of fish, and he made up some fish medallions, and we give him one of those each time. He says they are valuable.
And you pay Lin Lee, said Johnny, wise to the ways of commerce and the Chinese.
Of course, from your social petty cash.
The term petty cash could be pretty general.
The Earth Planetary Bank was paying for Earth's defense system out of petty cash. But Mr. Tsung was going on.
That button is a pre-run of prizes they are giving out in their new neighborhood bank program all through the universes. You know, to people who open up accounts. It will in each case be in the local language. You put it on your collar tab or a place like that, and then you hum a note, and as long as you move your mouth, the button will sing. They are gathering up all the folk songs of each local region.
Johnny got a kit out of his bag. He had brought it to help the project he was on right now. He took a micro-annealer and opened the button up and looked at its insides with a micro-viewer. It was just a molecular-sized set of storage cells with little triggers and relays. A tiny battery charged itself from room heat. An electron-vibrating prong set atmosphere molecules in motion to make sound. Simple, rather cheap. But that wasn't what Johnny was looking for. He often suspected the bank acquired information in peculiar ways, and he checked vocoders and such like to make sure they didn't contain a radio mic or a recording thread that could be taken back later. He had never found one so far, but that was the world he now lived in. He micro-annealed it back together and hung it on his buckskin collar.
"That isn't a standard one, he said to tell you,"
piped Mr. Tsung through his own monotone vocoder.
"He collected some old records of American ballads and put them in it. There aren't very many Americans, so it won't be manufactured for them."
Johnny cleared his throat and moved his mouth. The button hummed a wordless tune. Hadn't he heard that tune before? Scottish? German? Ah, it was called Jingle Bells. Then the button sang,
Galactic Bank, my friend so tried and true. Oh, what fun it is to have a neighbor such as you.
And then, in a proud voice, it said,
I am a customer of the Galactic Bank.
Well, that certainly wasn't any American ballad. Was Dries having a joke? He never joked, really. A very serious, small gray man. Johnny was about to take it off, but his laugh started it up again.
Home, home on the range, where the deer and the buffalo play.
Johnny remembered you had to keep moving your jaws to make it sing. Saliva pops or muscle tension or something. He started moving his jaws again.
Where there seldom is heard a discouraging word. Mr. Tyler,
came through the intercom from the nervous Pierre.
I can see Lake Victoria on the view screens through the overcast. It's totally clouded in ahead. Hadn't I better go on to Kariba?
Johnny went forward and took over the console. It was always overcast at Victoria. Johnny opened his mouth to call in for clearance, but the button sang,
And the skies are not cloudy all day.
What a lousy forecast, thought Johnny, and put the button in his pocket. 4. After glancing over the flying conditions, Johnny could not much blame Pierre. For a while now, they had been flying through the night, a fact which an experienced instrument pilot would not have thought about twice, and indeed, Johnny had scarcely noticed it. By looking very hard, and only then with trained pilot's eyes, one could just barely make out Mount Elgon rising above the black cloud carpet, for there was no moon, and such a peak became mainly visible because it blocked out certain stars. It was the screens which caused Johnny to forgive Pierre. So thick was the cloud layer below them that the view screens aimed at it were more snowstorm than image. You would actually have to know the shape of the lake and the compound to have any notion of what you were looking at. A lot of electrostatic disturbance. It must be raining like fury at the compound, rain flicked with lightning. Pierre, however, was in a state of mind that wasn't asking for anything but to stand on solid ground. He could not read the screens. He could not see anything but some stars above them and blackness below them, a blackness lashed now and then by some internal flash. He thought they were done for if they tried to go down through that. Who knew what hill they would run into? He would have been petrified had he known that Mount Elgon was higher than they were flying, but mercifully he did not know that. Nor, even more frightening, that they had passed by a couple of peaks even higher. Magnifying his alarm, Monsieur Tyler had come back to the pilot seat and hummed a strange song. Mon Dieu! One did not sing when one faced certain death. Lunacy! This book is continued on Cassette 14, Side 1.